This critique examines Life Coherent Peace, an academic synthesis by Dr. Bichara Saheli that integrates autopoiesis, life value onto axiology, and anti-violence frameworks to redefine peace not just as the absence of war, but as organized human and planetary flourishing.
Yeah.
And look, this material is just a brilliant, really ambitious integration of some profound thinkers, but we need to dive right into how the author can get the reader to those practical applications without, you know, losing them in the theoretical weeds first.
I am completely ready for this, yeah.
So diving right in, the theoretical integration of McMurtry, Maturana, and Galting is intellectually profound, but the sheer density of this synthesis in the first half risks overshadowing the paper's highly practical tools.
Right, yeah. The weakness here is, it's deeply structural. And I think it really becomes apparent when you just trace the progression of those early chapters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because the text spends just a massive amount of time detailing incredibly heavy, complex philosophical concepts. And it does it in a purely sequential way.
Right, it's just one after another.
Exactly. Like, we're given entire chapters dedicated solely to breaking down John McMurtry's life value onto axiology.
Which is a lot to chew on.
It is. It's this fundamental argument that all true value has to be grounded in actual life capacities rather than, like, market prices.
Yeah.
And then, right after that, we get this entirely separate, super dense section on Humberto Maturana's structural coupling and autopoietic unities, right? Just detailing the strict biological mechanics of how living systems maintain themselves.
Right.
And then following that, we transition into Johann Galting's cultural and structural violence.
Yeah, it's a lot of theory up front.
It really is. All of this theoretical architecture is built up in chapters 2 through 6. And by the time the reader finally reaches the life coherence arbitration protocol, which is all the way in chapter 9, they are just
conceptually exhausted.
Yeah, completely exhausted.
But, you know, I mean, if I'm looking at this from the author's perspective, I think my immediate defense is going to be that this foundational groundwork is non-negotiable, right?
Sure.
Because you are actively trying to dismantle centuries of traditional capitalist economic theory and replace it with a deeply biologically grounded framework. So my fear as the author would be, well, if I don't explain the underlying theory first, the reader just won't understand the application later.
Right.
Like, how do we prevent the practical sections from just feeling like, I don't know, a disconnected list of social complaints?
And that is a completely valid fear, honestly. And the author is correct that the reader does need this information.
Right.
But the weakness lies in treating the theory as this massive prerequisite rather than an active lens, you know?
Oh, okay.
You can think of it kind of like handing someone a manual for a complex machine.
Okay, I like that.
Right. So if you spend half the manual explaining, like, the underlying laws of thermodynamics and the physics of combustion before you ever show the person how to put the key in the ignition,
they're going to tune her out.
Exactly. The person who just needs to drive to the grocery store is going to put the manual down. They will completely lose the thread of why this framework matters for actual real-world conflict resolution.
Which means we need a way to maintain that theoretical rigor, but without front-loading the burden on the reader.
Precisely. So the suggestion here is to streamline the theoretical background by integrating these foundational concepts directly into the practical application sections, rather than, you know, isolating them in those early heavy chapters.
Right, right.
You want to let the practical application be the vehicle that actually delivers the theory to the reader.
Oh, I love that. So let's explore how that actually functions within the text itself, because the paper does feature this really excellent, highly structured section on the 5 domains of life-coherent transformation.
Yes.
That's specifically health, economy, education, ecology, and governance.
Yeah. And those domains are the absolute perfect delivery mechanisms for the theory.
Mm.
So instead of dedicating chapter 3 strictly to, like, Maturana's biology of love and the totally abstract definition of structural coupling, the author should just hold that concept back.
Wait for the right moment.
Exactly. Wait until you get into the health or ecology domains and then explain structural coupling right there in the context of a tangible, recognizable problem.
So instead of simply defining structural coupling as, the recurrent interaction in which organism and medium co-determine viable living.
Right.
Which is, you know, in a purely philosophical chapter, you show it in action. Like you show a child who develops asthma because heavy diesel traffic was permanently routed through their neighborhood.
Yes.
Due to some municipal zoning law.
Yes. That is exactly how you do it. You explicitly tell the reader, look, this is damaged structural coupling.
Oh.
The organism, which is the child, and the medium, the physical neighborhood, are interacting in a way that actively destroys viable living.
Wow, yeah.
And it's caused by institutional design. So you are teaching the reader the biological theory while their hands are already on the steering wheel of a real-world issue.
Right.
It makes the theory instantly sticky.
Oh, for sure. And you could apply that exact same methodology to Galtung's concepts too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like introduce structural violence precisely when you are discussing the economy domain, when the author is contrasting the money sequence.
Right, where money just makes more money.
Exactly, regardless of the human or ecological cost. When they contrast that against the life sequence, that is the optimal moment to show structural violence in action.
Totally.
You just don't need a standalone chapter defining it in the abstract. The economic application actually proves the theory right there.
And by doing that, you know, you pull the reader through the text so much faster.
Yeah.
Because they're learning the foundational concepts because they're seeing them solve problems in real time.
Which builds momentum.
Exactly. It builds incredible momentum toward the actual tools that the author provides later in the text.
Which naturally brings us to the ultimate tool of the paper and the primary test drive the author provides in Chapter 11.
Right.
So while the water privatization case study clearly illustrates life-blind organization, it misses an opportunity to showcase the framework's unique ability to resolve complex, competing life needs.
Yeah. When we look at Chapter 11, the water privatization scenario is just, it's incredibly safe.
Yeah, it's very clear cut.
Right. And the weakness of using this as the climax of the paper is that it presents a relatively straightforward kind of binary value versus disvalue situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because on one side, you have a public civil commons, which is designed to secure universal access to water, right? A fundamental life necessity.
Right.
And on the other side, you just have a private profit-driven entity that simply shuts off the tap if a vulnerable family can't pay their bill.
But let me play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
If you are introducing a deeply complex 8-step conflict resolution model to an audience, wouldn't you want a really clean, indisputable example first?
Well,
because the water case study clearly highlights a villain, the money sequence, versus a victim, the life sequence. Like, it proves that the framework can accurately diagnose systemic harm.
I mean, it does diagnose the harm, yes. And a clear villain is great for an introductory paragraph.
Okay.
But remember, this is a culminating case study of a highly sophisticated synthesis.
That's true.
The author has built this incredible 8-step life coherence arbitration protocol. And that protocol wasn't engineered just to point out obvious corporate greed, you know?
Right.
It was built to handle the agonizing, messy realities of governance where there really is no obvious bad guy.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. The water example simply doesn't make the protocol sweat.
Huh, right.
There's no true ethical collision because one side is clearly driven by life-blind revenue extraction.
So it doesn't test the limits of the machinery at all. We need to see the framework operate under, like, severe pressure.
Exactly. So the suggestion is to replace or, at the very least, heavily supplement that water privatization example with a case study that forces the protocol to navigate a true tragic choice.
Right.
Thereby fully utilizing all 8 steps of the arbitration protocol. We need a scenario where two genuine, completely legitimate life needs are slamming into each other head on.
Yeah.
A situation where traditional cost-benefit analysis just completely fails.
You know, it's funny. The material actually provides the perfect candidate for this in a brief kind of passing mention back in Chapter 8, I think.
Oh, really? Which one?
Yeah, the author outlines a scenario involving a suddenly displaced population needing immediate shelter.
Oh, right.
And the only available space is an ancient forest that serves as the ecological and cultural life ground for an indigenous community.
Yes, that is a phenomenal collision. And honestly, it should be elevated to the primary case study.
Absolutely.
Because in this scenario, both sides are fundamentally invoking life.
Right.
The displaced population desperately needs land, they need raw materials, and sanitation infrastructure immediately, or human beings will freeze, starve, or succumb to disease.
Yeah, it's literally life or death for them.
Exactly. But simultaneously, the indigenous community needs the forest intact for ecological continuity, for biodiversity protection, and for cultural survival.
Mm-hmm. So how do we actually walk the reader through that using the protocol? Because, I mean, a traditional technocratic approach would just, I don't know, assign a monetary value to the timber in the forest, compare it to the development costs of the housing, and basically the highest number wins, right?
Exactly. Traditional systems use cost-benefit analysis, which is exactly what this framework actively rejects.
Right.
So you take the reader step by step through the arbitration protocol to prove how it systematically negotiates this specific tension. You would start by diving deep into step four, which is identify thresholds of irreversibility.
Okay.
In the case study, you actually show the mediator mapping out the biological and cultural point of no return for both sides.
So the mediator establishes that, say, clear-cutting a specific percentage of the forest triggers irreversible biodiversity collapse.
Right.
And severs a cultural lineage that literally cannot be rebuilt once destroyed.
Exactly.
But at the exact same time, they map the threshold of irreversibility for the displaced population.
Yes.
Like the specific point at which a lack of shelter leads to irreversible physical trauma or mass mortality.
Yes, absolutely. Step four forces everyone at the negotiating table to structurally acknowledge the biological red lines of the other party.
Wow.
It takes the negotiation completely out of the realm of competing desires and grounds it entirely in biological and cultural survival.
Which pushes the process directly into step five, right? Which is seek compossible options before sacrificial trade-offs.
Yes.
And this is really the core engine of the framework. It demands a non-sacrificial solution. You don't just compromise by chopping down half the forest and saving half the people.
Right, because that still violates the life ground.
Exactly.
Right. So step five requires the identification of compossible flourishing, right? Finding a way for both systems to live simultaneously. And in this expanded case study, the author would detail exactly how that looks on the ground. Perhaps the protocol guides the groups to utilize adjacent, already degraded agricultural land for the temporary housing instead of the pristine forest.
Right.
It forces the use of regenerative building materials rather than pouring concrete, and it establishes strict no-go ecological zones.
Yeah.
Furthermore, it might even show the indigenous community actively leading the ecological integration of the temporary settlement, creating a symbiotic relationship rather than an adversarial one.
Oh, that's brilliant. Because by dedicating the primary case study to this step-by-step negotiation, you prove to the reader that the life coherence protocol isn't just, you know, moral absolutism or some utopian wish.
Exactly.
It is a highly disciplined, practical method for social learning under extreme constraints.
It proves the tool works in the agonizing real world.
Yeah.
And honestly, navigating that agonizing real world brings up a massive structural requirement of the protocol itself.
Oh?
Yeah. Step seven explicitly demands participatory languaging. The affected communities have to be deeply and genuinely involved in defining the terms of their own survival.
Which reveals a significant tension in how the text is ultimately delivered, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The paper rightly warns against epistemic violence and technocratic imposition, yet its own heavily academic terminology occasionally risks creating a barrier to the participatory understanding it demands.
Yeah, it is a profound irony within the text, honestly.
Yeah.
Because the manuscript is deeply concerned with ensuring that marginalized groups aren't colonized by top-down technocratic language.
Right.
Or forced into systems they don't understand. Yet the text itself relies heavily on highly specialized terms.
It really does.
We are constantly encountering phrases like ontoaxiology, autopoietic unities, epistemic colonization, and compossible flourishing.
Right. But I have to pause and challenge this, though.
Okay.
Because the precision of those academic terms is strictly necessary for the theoretical rigor of the paper, isn't it?
Well, yes.
Like, we cannot reasonably ask the author to strip out the very philosophical vocabulary that makes the synthesis unique and robust.
No.
If we just dumb down the language, we flatten the entire theory into generic self-help advice.
You are completely right. And we absolutely should not strip the academic terminology out of the paper.
Okay, good.
The terminology provides the necessary structural framing for scholars, for researchers, and policymakers. The weakness here isn't the presence of the jargon. The weakness is the absence of a linguistic bridge.
Ah, a bridge.
Right, because step 7 of the protocol requires participatory languaging. It insists that local communities must participate in the distinctions by which their situation is defined.
But how can a local community participate if the distinctions are locked behind graduate-level philosophy?
Exactly. If a facilitator walks into an indigenous community or a displaced persons camp and says, "We are going to map your autopoetic unities."
Yeah, they'll be escorted out.
Right. That is essentially committing the epistemic violence the paper explicitly warns against. The community will feel alienated, confused, and ultimately excluded from the very process designed to save them.
Okay, I see. So we don't change the theory, we just build a translation mechanism.
Exactly.
The suggestion is to create explicit linguistic bridges within the text that connect the high-level theoretical terminology to the accessible, dialogical language needed for real-world grassroots application.
Right. The author needs to show the reader, who, by the way, may be a future mediator or community organizer, how to translate this framework in real time.
Yeah.
So imagine adding a comprehensive translation guide or a series of practical scripts specifically dedicated to conducting a life coherence test in a community setting.
We just need to give the reader the exact words to use. Show them how to ask a community about damaged structural coupling without ever uttering that specific academic phrase.
Yes. Think about how powerful it would be if the author provided a script that instructs the facilitator to just ask, "How does this proposed policy affect the physical environment that sustains your daily life, your health, and your family's ability to work?"
Wow. Yeah, that honors Maturana's biological theory perfectly, but it uses words that actually mean something to a person defending their neighborhood.
Exactly.
And you can do the exact same thing for Life Blind Organization, right?
Mm-hmm.
You do not need a philosophy degree to ask a room full of people at a local town hall, "Is this infrastructure project prioritizing financial profit over the basic necessities our community needs to survive and thrive?"
Right. It immediately democratizes the concept.
It does.
And what about step 2 of the protocol, right? Which requires the mediator to map affected life capacities.
Yeah. How would you translate that?
The author could provide a clear, actionable table of questions. The facilitator simply asks the community, "Does this sudden change limit your ability to learn, to feel safe in your home, or to take meaningful action in your neighborhood?"
That's so much better, because by providing these explicit linguistic bridges, the author proves that the framework can actually operate in the relational domain of mutual legitimacy that the theory insists upon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it proves that this isn't just an exercise in high-level academia, but a genuinely deployable tool that stops the framework from inadvertently becoming just another language of bureaucratic control.
Absolutely. It empowers the reader to take the theory off the page and into the streets, which is really the ultimate goal of the entire synthesis anyway.
This is exactly what the material needs to ensure its incredible depth translates into widespread practical impact.
Yeah.
So, let's look at the core actionable feedback we've explored today. First, rather than front-loading the dense theoretical integration of McMurtry, Maturana, and Galting, weave those concepts directly into the practical 5 domains.
Right.
Explaining the theory through real-world applications like the health impacts of municipal zoning.
Mm-hmm.
Second, replace the binary water privatization example with the complex, tragic choice of the ancient forest versus the displaced population. Use that severe collision to thoroughly demonstrate how steps 4 and 5 of the arbitration protocol generate composable non-sacrificial solutions.
And finally, address the tension between academic rigor and participatory languaging by adding a practical translation guide.
Yes.
Perfect. Well, we warmly invite you to revise your framework with these structural and practical enhancements and submit it back to us for future feedback. We would love to see how this evolves.
Absolutely. And, you know, circling back to where we started, you do not need to force someone to study the laws of thermodynamics just to get them to drive a car.
Right.
But you absolutely must provide them with a vehicle that actually gets them where they are going.
Exactly.
This material has the engine of a paradigm-shifting vehicle, and now it's just about arranging the dashboard so the world can effectively steer it toward a more life-coherent future.